Dean, House Labor and Commerce. Let the record reflect that the time is 4:12 p.m. Members present, Representative Lynn, Guttenberg, Cott, Roakberg, and myself, Chairman Anderson. We have a quorum. The date is Monday, April 12, 2006. We have Senate Bill 289, Senator Bundy's bill, and then Senate Bill 310. On Wednesday, we have Senate Bill 300 and the appointment of RCA appointee. Actually, it wouldn't be an appointment. It would be the hearing of her recommendation, Ms. Janice Wilson. So we have Senate Bill 289. Who's here?
I'll make this quick.
Thank you.
My name's Jane Alberts, staff to Senator Bundy, who is tied up on the Senate floor. I will pass your sentiments on to him regarding his bills.
Good.
And we are here with Senate Bill 289, Insurance, by request of the division. I'm not going to say a lot about this because obviously I do not know the technical aspects of this 37-page bill, and it's referred to as the omnibus bill, and I'm merely a pawn in this adventure at the moment. So I'm going to pass on the technical aspects to Linda Hall from the division.
That's great. And I'd like to, if we can, move it out today, unless members have really consuming questions, which I hope not. You've been able to read the bill coming up, Linda, well in advance of the scheduling. Linda is here, my guests in great support.
Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance, and yes, I am in great support of this bill. It is the Division of Insurance bill that was put forward by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee.
You look nice today, by the way, as always.
Thank you. I am not going to spend a lot of time. I think I've met with each of you individually asking if you had questions. I know this is a fairly lengthy bill, fairly technical. I would just like to go through some general concepts, and as always, I would be happy to entertain any questions. The majority of the 37 pages deal with issues relating to life, annuities, and health insurance. The first sections 3 through 24, so you would take care of a third of the bill all in one fell swoop. Generally, we have laws that only apply to group health insurance plans, and we are changing in this bill those protections to consumers to also apply to individual health insurance plans. These protections include things like internal and external appeals processes for claims denial, prompt payment statutes. The other changes that are non-substantive in nature change the term health care and use the term medical care, which is defined in our statute also. But it's to make that consistent with both federal and state laws. There is Section 32, and I'm going to do all the health stuff first, that contains prompt payment of health claims, and that applies to individuals as well. We have made some changes in non-forfeiture language for annuities. Again, some model laws that we had not yet adopted. We have some changes that protect against excessive surrender charges on annuity products so that our consumers are not, gouged, for lack of a better term, but we do set some realistic surrender charges. We have added a provision to repeal some things that don't work today. The Small Employer Health Reinsurance Association, insurers are not using that mechanism. It is costing the association $10,000 to $12,000 a year to administer, and currently there are only two lives that are reinsured in that group. We have talked with the industry, and in particular the company that has those two lives reinsured, and they are all supportive of winding up the affairs of that association. It served a purpose a number of years ago, but no longer is actually serving that purpose. We have some corrections to statute references dealing with qualified domestic relations orders. We have also added the HIPAA mental parity provisions back into our laws. These are identical with provisions that were adopted in 1997. Congress continues to extend the Federal Mental Health Parity Act while Alaska's provisions sunsetted, and we're just trying to make sure our statutes are in compliance with federal law. The balance of the bill, thank you very much. I didn't mean to throw that. Balance of the bill deals with things other than life and health insurance. We have on page 15 and 16 an actuarial opinion guideline This is an additional tool that the division would use to more quickly identify an insurer that is in a troubled financial condition. The domestic insurer would be required to file their actuarial opinion summary, which would include their estimate of the range of reasonable reserves and to explain any adverse development. This is a National Association of Insurance Commissioners model that we would like adopted for use in regulating our domestic insurers. We have changes in requirements for a managing general agent to more clearly make us in line with how managing general agents are regulated around the country. We have provisions to streamline various licensing procedures to allow the division to publish a list of eligible surplus lines insurers on our website, to expand electronic communications, and that's the major pieces of this bill. And with that, I'll stop. And be happy to...
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
That's what I think of you often as. Thank you, Ms. Director. Representative Roekberg, then Guttenberg.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hall, the mental health parity provisions under HIPAA, we've adopted those before, but are they somehow optional, or how does that work in Alaska?
They've just sunsetted our provisions.
I know, but what did they say before they sunsetted?
What this bill says. I may need Katie to help me here.
I'm just looking at the title of whatever section it is. I'm not sure.
It's section 39 on page 31.
And I'm looking at the section. All right.
Oops. You okay?
Yep.
Go ahead.
Where's my pen?
Is this
my
what
knuckle?
You meant, Lynn?
Mental health for the committee members is surely in
speaking of mental health. Short
supply. Yeah, speaking of.
if you could state your name for the record and then
equally
answer
goofy.
The Roekberg's question.
That means parity, right?
Katie Campbell with the Division of Insurance and the Life and Health Actuary. I think the section you're referring to is on page 32, line 19. And this is identical, by the way, to the federal law that implements the mental health parity. But that particular section states that if it would increase the cost of the health plan more than 1%, that the provisions wouldn't apply. So there's some, I believe that's the provision that you were referring to. But this is basically yep. copied from our law that was adopted mm-hmm. in 1997.
I just refresh my memory. Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chairman.
Guttenberg, then Representative Crawford.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier about the repealing the Small Employer Health Insurance Association, and there's two lives currently in it. What happens when it's repealed? What happens to that?
There will no longer be reinsurance for those two lives. The insurance company will accept that risk themselves without reinsuring. They will take the full risk. They may reinsure it in their own reinsurance placement, but it would not be reinsured any longer through this mechanism.
But it won't affect those two at all.
It's not our understanding.
Okay.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you. On line 12-13 is the line that I was most concerned with. It says.
On what page, Representative?
32.
Okay.
It says. Except as provided otherwise in this title, a health and care insurance plan is not required to provide mental health benefits. That's the way it's been all along, or?
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, yes. We don't require, with certain mandate exceptions, and those specific things that are mandated in state law, we don't require any particular types of coverage to be in a health insurance plan. The individuals have a choice, or an employer that may create a health plan would have a choice. We've never, as a state, chosen to mandate the requirement of mental health benefits.
Okay. That, I was just looking at all the sections that led up to that. Seemed like that you were making sure that mental health was provided with parity, and then we get to that one, and it just is, but they can opt out altogether if they want to.
If they offer it, it needs to be done with parity, but they're not required to offer it.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you want to add anything to Thank you.
Representative Bettenberg, were you finished with your question? I wasn't sure if I cut you off. Okay, folks to testify online. And then we have Dr. Ramsey Nassar.
Yes, sir.
Yes, did you want to testify on Senate Bill 289?
Yes, I do, and I have to admit, and I apologize to the committee, that I'm here sort of in a slightly ignorant of the situation. I just got these two faxes in the mail, and they're only 2 pages out of the whole bill. So if I could just kind of give my testimony in general. I'm a psychiatrist from a Landon Clinic. I am a member of the Alaska State Psychiatric Association and the Alaska State Medical Association. I am a member of the legislative committees on both of those organizations. However, I'm testifying as a citizen and a concerned citizen only today. In general, my only thing I would like to testify to is that the line between mental health and physical health is becoming more and more blurred as we move on and learn more about these conditions. I can give a couple of examples. Survivability after a heart attack or a myocardial infarction is one of the major determining factors is the mental health status of the individual afterwards. Similarly, issues of chronic pain, which create a significant amount of work time loss, are also determined by the mental health status of a patient. So, in general, I am for parity in as much as we can, as a society and as a state, provide for that. And that'll be the end of my testimony. I'm available for any questions.
Okay, seeing no questions, thank you, Dr. Nassar. Oh, Representative Gutenberg has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor, and thank you for coming out. So what are your concerns about this bill specifically?
I just wanted to support moving towards parity. I don't have any specific concerns about this bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Nassar. Any other questions?
Very much.
You bet. I have no one else wishing to testify that signed up on the teleconference. Anybody in-house? Seeing, hearing, Representative Peterson? Okay, seeing no other ones, then do I have any questions or comments from the committee? Can I have a motion to move the bill? Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move, please substitute for Senate Bill 289. With individual recommendation and attached fiscal note or notes.
Okay, hearing no objection, so moved. Thank you, Linda. Sorry that it took so long to move it out today.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Okay, last bill up, we have Senate Bill 310, Employment of Prisoners.
You're Darwin, you're not wearing white and black and white stripe.
Mr. Chairman, I was wondering how we're going to afford those prisons up in Matt Valley. Now I know how we're going to have the prisoners guard each other.
Go ahead, Darwin.
In this building.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Darwin Peterson. I'm staff to the Senate Finance Committee. Senate Finance Committee is the sponsor of Senate Bill 310 at the request of the Department of Corrections. And the reason behind this legislation is to reactivate a program that was allowed to sunset last year. The Alaska Correctional Industries Program, as well as the commission, were repealed on July 1st of 2005 when the legislation that created that program was allowed to sunset. This bill reestablishes that program and improves the prison employment program in a number of ways. One of those ways is by allowing the department to take advantage of the critical federal prison industry enhancement program. This new prison employment program will also allow the Department of Corrections to actively participate and partner with private enterprise without creating unfair competition. As for the cost of the program, there won't be a burden on the state general fund since the entire program will be funded through program receipts. Furthermore, this bill encourages prisoner accountability and responsibility by allowing the department to make a deduction from the offender's wages for the cost of confinement. Such deductions can be used to pay for child support, victim restitution, criminal fines, civil judgments, and even the cost of their own utilities used while incarcerated. This is a vital piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman, if the state of Alaska wants to continue using prison employment as a tool for rehabilitation. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. There's representatives from the department here that can answer technical questions, and I'd be happy to answer questions as well.
Thanks, Darwin. Shar Griffin's here, but we don't need to bring her up unless someone has a technical question. Before we get into any questions to you, if there are any, I was on the Department of Corrections subcommittee a couple years ago, and I remember when we noted that there was compensation for, I was a new legislator, compensation for inmates, of course, and philosophically, the first thought was, oh my God, I mean, these guys and women, they committed crimes and then they're getting paid. And I talked to the commissioner off the record, and he said, oh, if you only realize, though, how important it is because of the construct of them being active and having money and having, you know, not treating them like dogs completely. Everyone. Where, I mean, they just say, hey, I have nothing to lose. I'll kill people and rape people and hurt people. Instead, there's some viability, and I have kind of a pursuit. And you listed a lot of those. I guess I'm maybe more making a comment, but would you agree that it's critical? When you say it's a vital bill at first blush, I could see the public saying, no, it's not. Why would we employ prisoners? But ultimately, it is critical to keep that encapsulated environment civilly in order, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For example, the furniture making program at Spring Creek and Seward, the laundry program here at Lemon Creek in Juneau. Those programs are important for rehabilitation to keep the prisoners working, occupied, and also to keep them active so that when they are released back into society, they can have a better opportunity of becoming productive members of society.
Thanks. Any questions, Representative Lynn?
Is there anything at all in this bill anyplace that would take a job away from a law-abiding citizen and give the job to a criminal?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, no. It's our position that there isn't anything in the legislation that would allow the department to do that. In the previous committee, there was an amendment that was adopted by the committee that was worked out as a compromise between the Senate Finance Committee, various representatives from the labor unions, as well as the members of the committee, just to ensure that language was inserted into the bill to specify that activity could not occur. In order, before the commissioner can authorize a contract with a private organization to conduct work using prison employees, the commissioner has to consult with the labor unions before they do that, just to ensure that we're not taking jobs away from any private citizens.
And that was the next question before we get to Representative Crawford. I see a lot of labor friends in the audience, so that there's support for the legislation. They're not signed up to testify. I see a head nod, I see the thumbs up, and then I see Don on one leg, which I don't know what that means. Representative Crawford.
No, I just...
Okay, Representative Lynn, follow.
I knew that in the previous committee. I just wanted to put it on the record again. You know, that's my concern.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'm concerned about is, say you everybody was working in the state, and you contracted with a labor contractor or whatever for prison labor to go out and clear a right of way for a transmission line or something. During the length of that contract, you know, work ran out, and you had a lot of local people that were unemployed. You wouldn't go back in and change that contract. I mean, how would you compensate for the changes in the picture of the workforce? And how long would these contracts run for? One work season, or over a year, or over 10 years? Because, you know, the work climate changes as to, you know, how many people are employed and how many aren't.
Through the chair, Representative Crawford, thank you for the question. That's a very good question, but without seeing contract language between the department and the organizations, I couldn't tell you what the contract date was. But the contract
is normally a year. I mean, it's not 10 years. Never heard of that.
Someone from the department may have experience with contracts like this in the past, but I would assume that if the labor organizations were going to agree to it, that they wouldn't want the contract date to be to such an extensive period that if the economy did take a turn for the worse and there were people that needed those jobs, that they would not be precluded from taking those jobs. So I don't know how long these contracts usually go for. That would be something that would be negotiated between the department and the private entity.
And I'll just comment on behalf of the sponsor that I know that that's a regulatory interpretation, not a statutory. It's on record just in the committee, and I think that it's important. I know that in other committees, I was talking to Darwin earlier, not today, but last week or a couple of weeks ago, whenever we last had the conversation, that one of the issues has been, and to bring labor on board, has been don't take jobs away from folks, you know, I mean, if they're out there. And I think the intent has always been through every committee that questions come up that, hey, that's not the intent. They're limited contracts, and they can be... I'm sure even voided, I mean, if necessary, I would hope. Jeez.
Well, I'd like to see something that gives us some guidelines to go by.
Yeah.
So, I mean, because this is fairly vague. And I mean, I see that you're going to consult with labor, but doesn't have anything that goes any further than that I can see here, unless I'm missing something.
Through the chair, the department may have interpretations of regulations that are currently in place that may address this.
That's good. And do you still have your chain gang amendment? I'm just kidding. Okay, do Representative Whitwick, is that a question to Darwin, or do you want to wait for the division to come up?
Well, it is a question to Darwin because...
Okay, go ahead, Representative Norm Roper.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peterson, the provisions on page 3, which seem to be on point in the last discussion, in section 2 of the bill, indicate that the language is changed from just having a minimal effect, a minimal negative impact on an existing private industry or labor force to be determined. I think it strengthens the language where it has the commissioner consulting with local union organizations. Now, I don't have a problem with that, but I do have a question about is whether why the issue about impacting existing private industry seems to have been removed unless the language on line 10, individual or private organization, is supposed to indicate that level of consultation, but it doesn't read that way. It's a policy call here. Could you explain that?
And before you answer, what your point is, okay, the prisons say, hey, we're going to go out and bid on a job or look for a job, and we'll go immediately to the unions, but we're not going to talk to the chamber or to the private sector.
Right, because that's the way it was drafted before. You look at both private and public sector here, but now there seem to be just focusing on
was that the intent, or is
union,
there acknowledgement to both kind of union and non-union?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Roper, the our understanding and our intent was for the amendment language to raise the bar for both public and private so that the commissioner consults with local organizations just so that they can ensure in that language it says that before issuing a contract, the commissioner ensures that the contract will not result in the displacement of employed workers, and that would be both in the private sector and labor employees, non-labor employees. So if the language is not specific enough, we would definitely support specific language, but we believe that this does go far enough to raise the bar for both labor and non-labor.
We have Representative Guttenberg and Ledoux in line, but I want to, before we move on, do you have an amendment, or can you think
just
of
follow
language?
Up, guys.
Yeah, because I don't think it does state. If you look at page 3, line 11, it says consults with local union organizations, but not any other, although I don't know if there is another organization.
Well, that's one thing I'd like to follow up. Maybe we should wait for the commission, the department to testify about what a private organization would be doing there in the first place, other than organizing providing an umbrella organization, and then how that would work. So
okay.
I'll defer any questions.
And if we have questions, I don't want to delay the bill. I promise to bring it up Wednesday to get it out, but because I wanted to end here shortly because we have session, only that reason. Representative Guttenberg, then Ledoux, then the department, then either we'll pass the bill out, or if you really have consternation, which I don't see why you would, we'll hold the bill.
Right.
Representative Guttenberg.
Section 9 on page 6. Proceeds from prison employment, including deductions from wages for cost of employment. That's a new paragraph. Could you explain how you expect that to work in? And what the intent is there?
You want the division to answer that?
Let me see if I have that statute with me.
Is that easier?
No, yeah,
well,
I will
let her.
I will use the divisions, the departments.
So we don't have to duplicate twice. And then, and maybe after you're done with Representative Guttenberg's question, I know we have Representative Ledoux on standby here for a question, but maybe you can answer Representative Roakberg's too.
Actually, I can answer the question. You correct me if I'm wrong. I believe this is the list and statute of all the program receipts, all of the things that can be used for to be funded with program receipts. So this is just adding this to make sure that we don't fund this to the general fund or some other program, that it generates its own revenue to fund the program.
So you're taking their wage and you're, so.
Go ahead.
Hi, for the record, Char Griffin, Department of Corrections Admin Services Director. Section 9 is intended to be for the Prison Industries Enhancement Program. Mm-hmm. That program is through the BJA, and they have an organization called the Correctional Industries Association that monitors it for them. It has a wide array of regulations that have to be followed. What it does allow for, because it requires on a PI program that you pay your inmates prevailing wage, and that you obtain that prevailing wage through the Department of Labor, and that you work with union organizations to not create unfair competition and so on. Since you're paying them prevailing wage, it allows one of the deductions to be for that offender to pay part of the cost of their incarceration. And so this part of the cost of their incarceration would support the program that they're working in, learning job skills and life skills.
Representative Guttenberg?
Yes. I mean, we're talking about prevailing wage. We're talking about minimum wage. I mean,
in a prison industry enhancement program, we're talking about prevailing wage. Mm-hmm. And the biggest reason for that is to not create unfair competition with private industry.
So are these in the trades or in the in furniture construction?
It would depend on who the private vendor were that you went into to a contract with. The Prison Industry Enhancement Program is required if you're going to go into a business with a vendor who transports and sells goods across state lines. So if they're going to make prevailing wage, then this would allow them to pay for part of their cost of incarceration. As far as what business it is, it depends on which vendor steps up and is interested in doing a PI program with the state of Alaska. There are currently 34 states involved in the Prison Industry Enhancement Program.
In the
prison industry, are they doing something that is exported into other states that crosses the state line, or?
Currently, we are not.
Okay.
And in that line of questioning, is it any prisoner that can work, any violation? I mean, can Robert Hansen murder 15-plus women, and he's a barber in Sewards? Was he trained in that? And then half of it goes to his pocket, and half goes to paying back the deceased family's relatives?
No, they have to be a classification that will fit in the job that they're applying for. Classification being minimum, medium security, maximum security, close security.
Gotcha.
So it would depend on what the position was that Offender Hansen was applying for.
And Representative Ledoux, then back to Roakberg.
Well, this goes back to what Representative Roakberg was talking about. Suppose they consult with, and we're on page 3, section 2. And I think it's great consulting with the local union organizations. But suppose the jobs are going to be something that the unions aren't currently involved in. How would you know whether or not it had an impact on those jobs if they're not now union jobs?
So into the future is your question?
Well, no, not necessarily into the future. I mean, I'm not quite sure, and maybe I just haven't read this thoroughly enough, but if the job isn't now, or that's going to be impacted, is not a union job, who would be saying, or who would have the information as to what impact it's going to have on employed workers. In other words, you're consulting with the unions, but if it's not traditionally a union position, I just throw that out for consideration.
Through the chair. That is a very good question, although the types of things that we would participate in a free venture with a private industry or in a PI program are things that could be done within the confines of an institution, which drastically limits what we may or may not be able to do, because this would not be something where we're sending offenders outside the confines of the facility to work. So, for instance, we had the auto body shop in Palmer. It would be something where maybe a small vendor would want to start up an auto body shop and have teach offenders how to do auto body work.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
That? And is auto body work a union trade?
I don't believe it is, but I would defer to the union to answer that question.
I don't think it is. Representative Crawford, is
that work? Bondo work.
Jeez.
No, all I was going to say was that there are some shops that are union. Mostly they're not, though. Alaska Sales and Service, I believe, is still a union shop. For the huge majority of them, they're not union.
Okay, Representative Rookberg, do you still have?
Yeah, I am curious about the I just gave a cursory review of the bill. You indicated prevailing wages here, not which would be over and above the one provision here that I'm looking for. Oh, the page 5, section 7, 201 sub B. The compensation established under A of this section is 50% or more of the minimum wage established in 23065. The commission may deduct the confinement cost. So I'm concerned. Is there somewhere here where the prevailing wage, has that been the standard now? Or
just through the chair, just a moment, Representative Rookberg, and I will find that for you. Prevailing wage would...
Once you find it, we'll adjourn and then bring it back just to see if there's any other questions rather than have a weird vote. We'll bring it back Wednesday. Go ahead.
Okay. Prevailing wage would only be on prison industry enhancement programs. The 50% of minimum wage would be...
Can you direct me to where that is in the
on
bill?
Free ventures, and where that is in the bill... is actually on page 4 in section 6, where it states compensation established by the commissioner under this section may not exceed 50% of minimum wage. And on, however, if required to comply with a federal statute or regulation, a higher compensation may be established by the commissioner. And so that would be the requirement of the PI programs.
PI prevailing wages?
PI programs, prison industry enhancement programs for goods that are going to cross state lines require that prevailing wage be paid.
So if we make office furniture and send it across state lines, you have to pay prevailing wages?
If we went into a contract with a vendor who wanted us to produce that office furniture and wanted to sell it across state lines, it would be required to be a PI program, or we could not participate.
I see here in the bill we're getting rid of the prison industries, the correctional industries program, and we're renaming it. Is this in transferring funds and getting rid of that? Is there a reason for that? Or?
The legislation for correctional industries sunset.
Are we in demob now because it did sunset, or what?
Pardon me?
Are we in demobilization now that the 1 year after because it did sunset?
I'm not sure if I follow that. This legislation has retroactive clauses, and if it's a critical piece of legislation. If we don't get legislation passed this year, we will not be able to continue not just prison industries, but working inmates.
Let me ask then, where does the committee schedule have you going next after Labor and Commerce?
House Finance.
Finance, and then, okay, and then it goes to the floor. I will hold the bill till Wednesday. I hope people get their questions answered. It sounds like, unless you're comfortable with moving it on, but it sounds like you have a few issues. But I want then one question, and then let's adjourn, and you can ask it just because I don't want to make people go right to the floor.
I'm not sure. It might take a day or so to find the answer out.
Yeah.
But the statewide average cost of confinement today is what?
107.42
per day.
42
per day.
Per day.
Per day.
That's a mix of hard and soft beds.
That includes the whole enchilada of the health care.
Through the chair, yes, it does.
You stated earlier that the commissioner may deduct a portion of that cost from those prisoners who make greater than 50%.
May deduct up to the cost of care.
Because the reason why I had that line of questioning in the bill, it's not clear. On section 7 of page 5, it says the commissioner may deduct the cost of confinement. Oh, never mind. I see it. So you got to reword. All right.
Up
never mind.
To.
So, got Representative Roper, I'll hold the bill on your
sure.
behalf. You can
get
review your questions. If there's not a need to hold the bill, we'll move it.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't see anywhere in the bill that allows for the prisoners to organize. Was that just overlooked?
God. Well, Mr. Chairman,
they are riot.
They are organized.
Representative Roper,
quickly. I'm just not sure. My question really relates to checking with private contractors, and one I can think of would be a catering company that organizes the kitchen and may hire inmates to work for them.
Okay, well, since the bill goes to House Finance, then why don't we have a motion to move it out today, and then we can address that over the next. It can't even be scheduled this week, so we can do that in the next, because we only have 2 weeks left, and it's a critical bill.
Yeah, we're under the 24-hour rule, too, though.
Motion to move the bill?
I'm sure Representative Roper can find his answer out.
Yep.
Between now.
There's always rules
good.
There, and we can...
No, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd move we move out of committee, Senate Bill, House CS Senate Bill 310, out of committee with individual recommendations and... Norm's fiscal note.
Okay. Hearing no objections, so move. We'll adjourn at 4:46. And now let's do the wave.